I was asking them, what happened? What happened? And they just kept saying, Little Jay was tripping. He stomped him out. He was tripping. He stomped him out.
A key witness takes the stand in the Fairbanks 4 hearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 5th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an East Coast college says it will attempt to repatriate Native art, but the Sea Alaska Institute still has questions.
If feasible and appropriate, what does that mean? It should be if it complies with the law.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
A hearing re-examining long-questioned murder convictions opened in state court in Fairbanks today. A group of Native men who've come to be known as the Fairbanks Four were convicted of the October 1997 beating of 15-year-old John Hartman on a downtown street in Fairbanks. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, new evidence has leveraged another look.
Alaska Natives George Fries, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, and American Indian Kevin Pease were convicted of killing John Hartman by two juries in two separate trials, but their case has long been plagued by allegations of subpar forensics, coerced confessions, unreliable witnesses, and even racism. Fairbanks 4 supporters rallied outside the courthouse where attorneys led by the Alaska Innocence Project introduced a key witness. William Holmes, a man serving double life sentences for other killings, says a group of his friends, not the Fairbanks 4, beat John Hartman in a random attack. Testifying Monday, Holmes describes himself as the driver who dropped off three friends who ran out of sight after Hartman, then returned a few minutes later in an agitated state.
Excited, out of breath, all of that. And I was asking them, what happened? What happened? And they just kept saying, Little Jay was tripping. He stomped him out. He was tripping. He stomped him out. So I looked over at Jason Wallace and I said, man, what happened? And he was just kind of just looking like he didn't even say anything. He was just in the zone, kind of looking forward, didn't respond.
Holmes' former friend, Jason Wallace, who's also serving life for an unrelated murder, told a public defender agency employee about the incident in 2003, claiming he was just the driver, a recently unveiled rendition of the story that will come up later in the month-long hearing. State prosecutor Adrian Bachman acknowledges new evidence in the case, adding she also plans to bring forward witnesses, including an Alaska Native cab driver who says she saw the Fairbanks Four near where Hartman was found dying in the snow.
And she describes the unusual haircut of Kevin Pease, the face of Marvin Roberts, and the elusive or evasive action of two other boys who she perceives are Native or Asian.
Bachman says the witness, who may appear later in the hearing, describes feeling a catch in her spirit, knowing something was amiss. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A Massachusetts college that planned to liquidate its Native art collection has called it off. The pieces are from 52 tribes, including Tlingit and Haida items that might be sacred. Now the country's oldest theology school could get dinged with penalties as feds investigate. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Over the summer, the Andover Newton Theological School, or ANTS, quietly decided it would sell 80 pieces of its Native art. But it didn't stay quiet for long. The museum that's housed the collection since the 1940s alerted hundreds of tribal leaders. Rosita Worrell, the president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says these are more than inanimate objects.
The halibut hook has spiritual dimensions to it. And in this particular case, we have a halibut hook with a wolf.
Worrell believes the school also has a Southeast shamanic doll. And under federal laws, if a college or museum receives federal funds, these items are subject to repatriation. So how did Andover Newton wind up with such a vast collection of Native Alaskan, American, and Hawaiian art?
It was, you know, through their own missionaries going out into the field and collecting objects. Like I tell the story over and over again, they collected our sins.
What those missionaries considered sins then could fetch the college $1 million now, if the legality of the sale hadn't come into question. Peabody Essex Museum President Dan Monroe says the school was confused from the jump. It didn't file an inventory or summary providing tribes with information, and the college assumed the museum could cherry-pick what was subject to the law. Only tribes can.
The museum, ANTS, no other party can actually make those identifications.
Even so, the school claims that information came from Peabody Essex.
Okay, so let's take that and dissemble it. Number one, we could never tell them what objects in their collection are quote-unquote subject to NAGPRA because we have no standing in the law, and we perfectly well understand that.
NAGPRA is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. In 2009, Monroe says the Onondaga tribe asked the school to give back a wampum belt. The school denied its request. As a privately funded college, it thought it wasn't subject to the law. But here's the problem with that. The students pay with Stafford loans.
If the institution receives federal financial assistance, whether directly or indirectly, that would be receipt of federal funds.
That's David Tarler. He works at the NAGPRA office in D.C. Tarler said the school is being investigated, and penalties can range from $5,000 for each failure to comply up to about $21,000 in this case. Then there's aggravating circumstances, like previously denying a tribe's claim. Dan Monroe says he's still not sure the college gets it.
You know, on the plus side, they've made the commitment not to sell objects. They've made a commitment to comply with NAGPRA. And those are admirable and very positive decisions on their part, regardless of the means by which they arrived at them.
Copenhaver said he was too busy to comment for this story, but he forwarded a letter. It said, "We will proceed to repatriate artifacts if feasible and appropriate ways can be found to do so."
I mean, that set up a red flag to me.
Rosita Worrell again.
If feasible and appropriate. What does that mean? It should be if it complies with the law.
Aside from the law, she says there's a larger underlying issue the school doesn't seem to understand about the collection.
Andover, if you read their letters, they keep referring them to artifacts. They are not artifacts to us. They are at-u. They are living things to us. They're spiritual things to us.
Andover Newton Theological School did recently reach out to the Onondaga about the belt. Southeast tribes are still waiting. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
President Obama this morning unveiled a package of global initiatives aimed at cracking down on illegal fishing. He also announced two new marine sanctuaries, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, they are not in Alaska.
Obama delivered the message in a video address to an oceans conference in Chile.
Building on our actions to keep illegally caught fish from coming into U.S. markets, today we're announcing new partnerships to empower developing nations to fight illegal fishing in their own waters.
Among the new initiatives is Sea Scout, a banner for international cooperation in the use of technology to improve detection and coordinate enforcement. The administration says it plans to make new tools available, like light sensors on satellites, to help other countries detect suspicious night fishing. Secretary of State John Kerry said at the Oceans Conference that the world must double down to stop illegal fishing.
It has grown into at least a $10 billion a year industry, illegal fishing. And the only sustainable fisheries are legal fisheries. Enforcing the law is essential for the survival of our fisheries in order to ensure fairness and to keep organized criminal groups out of the ocean.
President Obama also announced that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is taking steps to create two new marine sanctuaries. They are far from Alaska. One is in the Potomac River in Maryland, the other off Wisconsin in Lake Michigan. They are not especially controversial in those states. Obama also sidestepped conflict by going through NOAA, rather than issuing a presidential decree to declare national monuments. But for those who hope or fear that Obama will create a Marine National Monument in Alaska, take note. Obama says he's not done.
In the coming months, I will look for opportunities to protect even more of our waters.
Congressman Don Young last week predicted Obama will create an Aleutian National Monument, which Young opposes. Young also disputes that the president has any power to create marine monuments under the Antiquities Act. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, landing on an active Aleutian volcano for science.
The fumarole vent was huge, and it made the sound of almost like a jet engine.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Sunday night, about 70 community members gathered on the park strip in Anchorage to honor those who died while living outside on the streets this summer. The candlelight vigil was held on the same spot where people gathered 32 years ago to demand an emergency shelter for people without housing. KSKA's Ann Hillman attended the event and has this story from the Urban Affairs Desk.
Tina Mafuau is with the St. Anthony Samoan Choir. She says they chose to sing at the ceremony to teach their youth about helping others and to send a message to the people in Anchorage.
One candle each time would make a difference anywhere, in any dark place. So I hope the city of Anchorage will rise up to the call that's needed by our brothers and our sisters that are less fortunate.
Community activist Samuel John said part of the solution is changing how people who are experiencing homelessness view themselves.
What I feel that every one of us should do is not just give them our change, not just give them our leftovers, but what we should do is really sit down and think about how we are going to give them pride in themselves.
Mayor Ethan Berkowitz says that means acknowledging people without homes as people.
And when you stop and you talk and you get to know them as individuals, and you hear their stories of a veteran who served his country, of a victim who was subject to the most horrific kind of abuse, as someone who's fleeing, as someone who's dealing with mental illness, calling those people just homeless does an injustice.
After the ceremony, community member Christina Mensoff approached the mayor and the governor with her concerns and asked for solutions. She says, as she bikes through town, she sits and speaks with many people who live in the camps.
You know, a lot of it has to do with like just setting up a place where they can be safe and they don't have all these homeless camps everywhere, and just like, you know, giving them the mental health that they need in that area.
Berkowitz says the municipality is working on solutions like helping open the Housing First Project Safe Harbor at Merrill Field and providing scattered site housing around the city. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
At least 8 people in Juneau have died in the elements in the past 3 years. These are just the ones known about based on the 2012 Juneau Homeless Coalition survey. John Knudsen is the most recent. The 56-year-old's body was found in the wetlands last month. KTOO's Lisa Fu spoke to his brother James Knudsen at Juneau's shelter and has this story.
There are moments when James Knudsen forgets his younger brother is dead.
Riding on a bus, just starting looking out where you can see him. I was, you know, around Schweitzer or AMP or down at the bus barn. You know, places you know where he hung out. Catch myself looking for him.
John Knudsen's body was found in the Mendenhall wetlands in mid-September. From the condition of his body, Juneau police said he had likely been in the water and exposed to the elements for at least several days. Knutson's body was sent to the state medical examiner. Juneau police still don't know what caused his death. James Knutson doesn't either, but he has a theory.
My suspicion is that he was by either Schweitzer Creek or Lemon Creek and fell in there and then got washed out.
Knutson says his brother was staying with a friend in the Lemon Creek area. He assumed he was safe, even though he hadn't heard from him in a few weeks. The two brothers had always looked out for each other.
Somebody got in a little scrap with somebody else and somebody would show up and help out. But this time I didn't have any feeling. I mean, I thought he was safe.
At the moment, Knutson is staying at the Bergman Hotel. He says he's been homeless for 10 years. He says his brother became homeless when he split up with his girlfriend.
He had his issues with alcohol, kind of like other people like I do at times. And it's kind of a tough life living on the streets. And I've been there and we both lived on the streets together at different times.
Just 1 year apart, the two brothers of seven children total were close growing up and as adults. They were both born in Juneau, but spent their early years in Hoonah. James Knutson's favorite story about John is one their mom used to always tell.
My dad had just got back from deer hunting, had a couple of deer hanging them out in a shed. And that night, my brother came up to me and had a butter knife in his hand. He goes, "Jer, let's go hunt some deer." That's what they called me, Jer. I looked at my brother and go, "Oh, what if we run into a bear?" He's holding a butter knife. He goes, "Oh, we'll jump on his back."
Knutson says his brother fell into the wrong crowd at a young age, got in trouble, and paid for it the rest of his life. Knutson says his brother went to a mining trade school.
Instructor, you know, thought he'd be a good mine worker, but with his felony, he couldn't get a job at the mine. I tried to talk to him about, you know, I guess some people could work around a felony, you know, as far as working in a mine, but my brother just wouldn't look into it.
Instead, John Knutson went into construction and mechanical work.
Yeah, he's a really good worker. Just alcohol got the best of him.
James Knutson continues to struggle with alcohol. He'd been sober for 2 months, but started drinking again while planning his brother's memorial services. He says John's body will be cremated, his ashes spread over their parents' graves. John Knutson would have been a candidate for Juneau's Housing First project if the remaining $2.4 million in funding is secured by January, the housing could be complete as soon as 2017.
In the meantime, we should just not accept this as an acceptable reality, because it's not acceptable. Like, it's unacceptable to have people die in the street.
Glory Hole Executive Director Maria Lovashuk says if you see someone laying outside, ask if they're okay. If they're not, call for help.
Like, I just need to treat people like human beings.
Lovashuk says helping people in that way shouldn't depend on how much they've drunk or how much money they have. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
New diesel power plants in two Bristol Bay communities were on a list of Denali Commission projects announced alongside President Obama's visit a month ago. As KDLG's Hannah Colton reports, long-expected power plant projects in Togiak and Kilgannik are still in early stages.
Since 2000, the Denali Commission has partnered with the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, working down a list of communities to receive bulk fuel and power plant projects. Joel Niemeyer is the federal co-chair of the Denali Commission. He says the Togiak and Kilgannik projects have been on the docket since long before the White House announcement.
The commissioners prioritize, or they review a prioritized list, and they say yes to this or no to that. And they assigned a large portion of our FY15 money to power plant projects. And Togiak was on the list before Kilgannik. And so that obviously meant we needed to fund Togiak first and then Kilgannik next.
Niemeyer explained that Denali Commission energy projects get funding from a whole mix of sources.
Not only Denali Commission money, but also U.S. Department of Agriculture, Rural Utilities Service funding.
The commission generally funds about 80% of each project. Then the partner agency, either AEA or AVEC, covers the remainder. In the case of Togiak's new diesel plant, AVEC will contribute just over $1 million, adding to $5.6 million from the Denali Commission. Togiak City Administrator Daryl Thompson says the city's been looking forward to having a more efficient diesel plant for several years now.
Our power plant is kind of a piece together series of modules that we keep repairing so we can have power, but we do need a new power plant.
Thompson says the new plant will be located near the old schoolyard on a site that the city donated to AVEC. He says the new plant is actually the first piece in a slew of projects planned to meet the area's energy demands.
What AVEC had envisioned was a car plant, tank farm, and a multi-bill. We could do twin hills also by a transmission line. So that whole project is penciled in at $18 million. So at least the power plant is a start, and maybe to get funding in the future to complete the rest of the project.
The new diesel plant is in the final design phase now, and Thompson hopes construction will start in 2016. In Kilgannik, power plant construction is a little further off.
We are really at the infancy stage of this project and have named a project manager on our end.
Emily Ford is an energy policy and outreach manager at the Alaska Energy Authority, the state partner for the Kilgannik project. She says the AEA hopes to start coordinating with the village soon. Though a White House press release in early September outlined costs for the Kilgannik project, the last bit of funding, $300,000 from the USDA, didn't come in till several weeks later.
The total budget allocated so far, and this includes the Denali Commission and the state funds, is $3,850,000, and roughly $3.1 million of that is Denali Commission funds.
The AEA will provide the 20% cost share match. Ford says if all goes well, construction will begin in Kilgannik in 2017. In another project separate from Denali Commission funds, Ford says the AEA is also looking at wind energy in Kilgannik. In 2011, they granted the new Kilgannik Village Council $105,000 to study the feasibility of installing wind turbines. That report is due out at the end of this year. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
In September, a team of scientists crawled around the summit of seven volcanoes in the Aleutian Islands. They updated seismic sensors, replaced 8,000 pounds of batteries, and visited one summit that geologists hadn't been to since the 1940s. They also took a lot of samples. University of New Mexico professor Tobias Fischer landed on active volcanoes in the Aleutians to capture gases. Fischer says the samples will help tell the story of deep Earth systems and how they are connected. He says landing on Kiska volcano was a first ever event for geologists.
When we landed with the helicopter and walked over there, the fumarole vent was huge. It was, 5 or 10 meters in diameter, something like that. And it was quite deep, and it made the sound of almost like a jet engine. So it was extremely loud hissing sound that indicates that the gas is, magmatic gas coming up from the magma to the Earth's surface at very, rapid speeds and at high pressures. So it was quite loud. It wouldn't be possible to easily talk standing next to that fumarole.
Is that common when you are at any of the volcanoes that you studied? Do they all make noise or are some of them sort of silent?
Yeah, they can be silent as well. And Gariloy was quiet. It almost made no sound, right? But it had high temperature, 300 degrees, 350 degrees probably, but very quiet, very calm degassing. And I have worked on gas emissions that are 1,000 degrees hot, and they make no sound, right? And then there are others that are lower temperatures, and they make a huge sound. They're sometimes so powerful that it's very difficult to get close and collect a sample.
You collected gases at these summits. What will the gases that you've collected tell you as you're researching them now?
Well, they are really the first gases that were collected from some of these vents. I don't think anyone has ever sampled Kiska, Gareloi, and Kanaga gases. So what we will find will really shed some light on what are the volatile components doing in the Aleutian arc. So what are the sources of the gases that come out of the volcano?
Tobias, why should people care about this? What is important in understanding where the water is coming from and what the gas composition is?
Well, volcanoes are really the origin of the atmosphere. So what we're breathing today, the composition of the atmosphere, comes from the Earth's interior. And understanding, you know, what the volcanic gas compositions are, we can understand the formation of the atmosphere. So that's one kind of basic research part. The other thing is, if you are looking for, you know, trying to find geothermal energy, you need to know where to find it, where to look for it, and volcanic gases are really good tracers of heat sources in volcanic systems. So you can make some pretty good guesses on where to drill for geothermal energy.
Tobias Fischer is a geochemist and volcanologist at the University of New Mexico. The research from the expedition will be released over the next year. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Hannah Colton in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.